Here's what we're going to do. This is not going to be run like a panel. Okay?
Thank you.
We're not going to do that. I've known this guy forever. All right, we're
40-something years with this guy.
We grew up practically kids together. So this is going to be a conversation, and I'm going to do this as a conversation we would have in a bar somewhere, and you're going to be sitting around with us. So I'm not going to do like a thing, question and answer. You know, if you got something to say, you know, without being rude about it, you know, we'll get you involved in the conversation.
Let's be friends.
But Bob's an amazing guy, and I wanted to kind of take you through his career and why comics and why he was recognized. And I was there by Robert Downey Jr. and the entire cast and crew of Iron Man for having been the number one inspiration to them in the movie that they did. I don't know if any of you were at Hall H that day when they brought him up on stage. Wasn't that absolutely amazing?
Are you the guys that stampeded me afterwards? That was the scariest moment of my life.
It was the greatest moment of my life to see him. Do you know how rare it is for comic book creators, artists, and writers to get credit, to get a spotlight when a big movie's made on their work? And then you have to look in the end credits right below the craft services and the drivers.
Don't knock craft services, man. The food is awesome on an A-list movie. You know that.
Most pissed off I ever got watching a movie was when I, about 10 minutes into the closing credits, I see like this little line, created by Stanley and Jack Kirby, you know. And it's grossly unfair.
Well, let me give you a prime example of that, all right? Now, you notice I brought my Ant-Man jacket that I wore to the premiere, right, which was a week ago Monday.
Ant-Man.
Some of you that follow me on Facebook, you know, I had this actually made with Ant-Man colors and stuff like that. So I'm there. Dave Michelinie and I created Scott Lang back in, 1977, 78?
Is that right?
When it was Marvel Comics Presents, right?
Yeah.
There wasn't a single person out there involved in that movie who could give a damn whether we were there or not. You know, I mean, it was like, there was like guys who were playing thugs who had two lines in the movie who was getting like, you know, tons of photographs, stuff like that. And my girlfriend leans over. She goes, "There's something wrong with this." She goes, "You guys actually created this stuff. And nobody seems to give a damn." You know?
It is.
Explain. Explain.
Nobody gives a shit.
No. I mean, there is something sort of surreal about it that there seems to be, and we both work in the film industry, so you know, there seems to be a disconnect between the people who actually create the stuff, and although I got to say, on Iron Man, the guys were pretty good to me. All right, I got to say they were pretty good to me, as you saw in Hall H. You know, it's like they were quick to give me credit, and that was a great moment for all of us.
It was.
Yes, you know, for those who fight to get any sort of recognition whatsoever.
Especially if you know his backstory. I want you to get to know this guy the way I know him. And we're going to do all the fancy schmancy stuff as we go.
Are we fancy schmancy? There he is. Oh, look. Well, look what Jason did. Look at this.
Yeah.
What's the heart for?
This is.
He did that. He put a little heart on there.
It's the red for Iron Man and the yellow for Iron Man.
But it's a heart.
It's a splooge.
It's a splooge.
I traced yours.
And by the way, I got to tell you this. That whole Hall H thing that happened was triggered when one comic book fan got up in Q&A and went up to the podium and said, "Where's Bob Layton? What about Bob Layton's contribution here?" And in fact, I see sitting in the back the comic book fan who got up and asked that question.
Aaron, take a bow. Aaron.
Aaron, what did you say at that moment?
So that's when we decided to make the Hollywood people finally understand that it's time for the creators to get some credit, and we made it happen. So I wanted them to give credit where credit was due. And I wanted to find out where the ideas came from and why they took his characters and where they
Thank you, Aaron, so much. It was the only standing ovation I've ever gotten in my life, you know? It was a really touching moment for me, you know?
So Bob's from Indiana, and I went to school in Indiana. I got my 3 degrees at IU, and that's when Bob and I became friends, and we had mutual friends in Indiana. Roger Stern, you guys know the work of Roger Stern, one of the greatest writers in the history of comic books. Roger had the WIUS campus radio show on before my show. And we bonded on the air on radio, found out we were both comic book fans.
There was no internet or cell phones or any kind of thing in those days. It was like a lot of mail correspondence and stuff.
Nothing. And then Sterno put me in touch with Bob, and we would all hang out. And there was this little Indiana comic book mafia group that took place. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into comics, why you fell in love with comics, where the art thing comes from, and what the Indiana mafia was?
Well, that's your name for it. I don't think any of us, we're mostly pussies. I don't think anybody was really like mafia types, okay? For me, everyone has a hook, you know, that makes them love this medium or whatever. And I learned to read from comics from my big sister when I was 4 years old. And by the time I started school, I was reading proficiently. So the power of that medium became very evident to me very early on. And interestingly enough, the first comic I read was a Wally Wood comic. Which would be, my life is filled with mind-numbing coincidences, by the way. The very first comic I read would wind up being the apprentice to the guy whose first comic I ever read.
Do you guys know who Wally Wood is, by the way?
Yeah, well, yeah. For you younger guys, that's another panel, okay? But one of the greats of all time, yeah. So, learning how to read and skipping a grade in school, I mean, graduating at 17, you know, it really kind of put the hook in me. I never had a fireman or policeman stage. I wanted to be a storyteller. That's what I wanted to do. Whether it was art, whether it was writing or whatever, that was the hook, and it never went away. So after, I grew up very poor. So, you know, I was like a middle kid in five. My mother was a waitress and raised us all waiting tables. Single parent thing. I was a latchkey kid before they had a name for it, right? So comics were my escape. You know, comics was what how I escaped the otherwise a kind of a bleak existence. I wasn't going to go to college. I did get a scholarship offer, but it was by the Christian Science Monitor.
Oh, really?
Yes, and knowing me now, could you actually see me doing that?
No, sir.
Because I'd
be getting in trouble.
I'd be sneaking Spider-Man in behind Jesus and everything. You know, it's like. So I decided to be entrepreneurial and start, like, basically, you know, working on my own fan art and stuff like that. And when I hooked up with Roger and Duffy Volan and Roger Slifer, the late Roger Slifer,
was John Byrne part of that?
John Byrne was part of that. John Byrne's very first work ever in comics was working on my fanzine, which was called CPL. Is it up there? Thank you. Somebody, one guy remembers that. Jason, is it up there?
You're skipping around a little bit.
Well, I know, but he said it was going to be conversational, right? I gave him an outline. We're throwing it out.
Yeah.
You have to stick with it.
Just find it.
Just find it. So they were crappy little fans. It was with some.
It wasn't crappy. I wrote for it.
Well, no, starting out with. They were like really. But, you know, the fun part, this guy knows what we're talking about, is every issue, it got a little better, got a little better, got a little better.
Alex Toth.
And what happened was, since there wasn't really any internet, we found out that a lot of professionals really loved getting the magazines, because we were writing stories. But he was reviewing. You were a comics reviewer.
Among other things, yeah.
He was writing reviews of, like, top five comics of the year, that kind of thing like that. So they started contributing to our magazine. We started getting like professionals sending us drawings to use in the thing or whatever. So
tell them about Joe Sinnott's drawing that you used.
Oh, Joe Sinnott was always such a great guy, and Sterno got this harebrained idea because it was just about the time Burt Reynolds had done that centerfold for
Playgirl magazine,
right? So Sterno got this dumb idea of doing Plaything of the Month, and he had Joe do the parody of that with the thing laying on a bearskin rug naked, you know, which was the centerfold for one of those issues. But it was like fun stuff like that. But what happened was then Phil Suling and Bud Plant, two great guys, Phil Suling, one of the founder of the modern day, you know, drink market. He recognized that the whole bunch of us were really talented guys. You know, he goes, these are kids that are up and coming. And he and Bud made a deal to finance the fanzine. He said, we will buy your entire print run and distribute it ourselves. So from a very early age, I was involved in business side of this stuff.
Yeah, so you were an entrepreneur, not just an artist.
And what we would do is we would send 25 copies up to Marvel and up to DC every time we came out with an issue, just so they could pass it out on there and read it or whatever. And it started like we would get more and more contributions from professionals. It really got to have a little reputation. And I think we all, at that point, almost nobody didn't wind up going professional from that.
No, but was it your intent to use that to open the door to get into the comic book professional world, or were you just doing it as a fanboy love for the hobby?
Yes.
Ah.
To both, yeah, to both. I mean, obviously John Byrne wanted to get in the worst way, and some would say he did. But, we all loved comics at that time, you know, and we wanted them to be better too, you know, so that's why we were critical. Steve Grant, you know, I mean, great comic book writer, was one of the writers for CPL as well. And he had the name CPL, which is Contemporary Pictorial Literature, which is a scientific name for comic books, which is a big overblown stupid thing as an adult, but when you're a kid it sounds cool, right? So we kind of did, and from there, like I said, we got noticed. Stuff got noticed. And we had a little character in the CPL book. It was like a mascot called Raj 2000. And he was like the fake editor or whatever. John had always sent in these little sketches of from his sketchbook that we could use as spot illustrations in the thing. And one of them was this cute little robot.
Was he named after Roger Stern?
Well, it was named after Roger Stern and Roger Slifer. They were both Rogers. Oh, yeah. So two-thirds of the staff was named Raj. So that's why we named the robot Raj 2000, right? Because at the time, 2000 seemed a long way away. What happened was Charlton...
Yeah, I want to get into that.
...saw Bill Pearson, who was at Charlton, Nick Cuddy.
You guys know Charlton Comics.
Charlton Comics, a small publisher in Derby, yeah. Connecticut. There'll be a whole movie about that coming up soon, by the way. Someone's doing a documentary on the Charlton...
the connections and everything?
And everything. It's, like, amazing. But Charlton was a very unique place. But they saw what we were doing, and at that time, remember, DC had The Amazing World of DC Comics.
It was like fancy. Was one of them guys that produced that every month.
Produced that. And Marvel had a magazine called Foom. And they were trying to get back into the superhero genre, and they said, would you be interested in producing a fanzine for us? You know, and that's kind of hard to do because they're Charlton and, like, nobody gave a shit, right? But at the same time, they said, oh, by the way, we have an entire library of unpublished material left over from the original action hero days, including unpublished Blue Beetles and Captain Adams and stuff. You're welcome to them. As you're a fan and somebody says, I'm going to give you classic material that's never been published, you know, I mean, what do you think I said? Of course, you know? So... as well as CPL, we came out with the Charlton Bullseye. And that was like a bi-monthly thing that ran for about a year.
And I'm sure all of you know that these Charlton superheroes were later adapted by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons into The Watchmen.
The Watchmen, yeah. They were the original Watchmen. But you'll notice that question cover up there, the very first question story done since the original.
After Ditko.
Written by somebody on this panel. It was not me.
My boss let me do this, and I got to speak to this for a second. Call me up, and I had just started doing my first professional comic book writing for DC. I was writing The Shadow. I was doing this bizarre comic book called Beowulf.
Oh, it was, too. Were you on drugs then?
I was in college.
Oh, okay, he was on drugs then. Okay.
I never said that. And besides that, I did Tales of the Unexpected, Hopping Down the Bunny Trail, which has been listed as one of the most sick comic books ever made in the history of comic books.
You're a strange young man.
There are websites devoted to it. He said, how would you like to write the question, post-Ditko? And I said, oh my God, he's my favorite Charlton character. He wears a fedora. I love the Shadow, the Green Hornet, the Spirit, anybody, the Sandman, the original.
Get to the good part.
So I said, who would be the artist? And that's when he told me, Alex Toth. One of the great all-time legends in the comic
absolute
world.
Top five cartoonists of all time.
In that,
and he wanted to do it. He said, that sounds like fun. Sterno did, actually, you know.
Really?
But I would correspond. I got those little cards from him all the time.
Yeah.
And we were corresponding back and forth. And I just, he was a fan of this stuff, you know. And I just said, we have the rights to do that. Would you be interested? And of course, you know, money was had to change hands, but he was, you know, he just said, yeah, I'd love to do it. Well, there wasn't really a lot of coercing with him.
He taught me more about graphic storytelling in that short period of time I worked with him than anybody else had ever done for me. Biggest influence on me in that regard for my future.
We're talking fanzines here, okay? You know, it's like, we're not even talking professional comics at this point.
And it's been reprinted in the DC Archives, Action Heroes Volume 2 or something like that. And it's beautiful. It's black and white, and Toth is amazing.
He should never be anything but black and white.
Oh, yeah, that's so true.
Exactly.
But you had Ditko.
Yeah, we had Ditko. Actually, we had one story. It was Steve Ditko inked by John Byrne, something you'll probably never see again, you know?
So you have to understand Bob Layton's entrepreneurial spirit here. We're kids in Indiana, and he's
I was 19 years old.
He's publishing material by Toth and Ditko and getting rights to all of these superhero characters, and it was really amazing. So how did you take that and get to the next step in this business?
Well, what happened was Bill Pearson, who worked at Charlton, was also a former assistant of Wally Wood, who lived there in Derby, Connecticut. And he showed Woody the stuff, and Woody said, wow, this kid looks like he got a little something. And he goes, tell him if he's ever out east, you know, I can always take him on as an assistant. So with $200 in my pocket and a Galaxy 500 station wagon that broke down a lot, I drove to the East Coast. I knew, because remember, I threw the first convention ever in Indianapolis at NAPCON.
I spoke
remember
there.
That? Yeah, remember?
Yeah.
That was in 1975. And this was shortly after that con. I'd met Al Milgrom and Walt Simonson, and they were just starting their careers. And they said if I ever got out east, I could crash on their floor until I found a place. So I slept on Walt Simonson's floor, you know, for a few weeks till I could find an apartment. I went to work as an apprentice to Wally Wood.
Unbelievable. Now, I have to tell you a quick anecdote. This comic book convention he ran in Indianapolis in 75.
Done everything, man.
He said, I need you to speak there. And it was the first comic book convention I ever attended as a professional and had to speak. I was writing The Shadow at that time. It was my first stuff. And I give my first talk, and then there's a bunch of young people that came up afterwards, I remember, and I was signing copies of The Shadow or whatever else I was writing. And I was talking to these kids that would come up to me, and I was so excited to be at my first convention as a professional. It was just great. Anyway, that's 19.
That's also where I met Dick Giordano for the first time.
At that con?
Yeah. That's to be my lifelong mentor.
Yeah, I want to get into that
relationship. Well, that comes after Woody, yes.
Well, let me just tell you that was 1975. We jump now to 2000 and, I don't know, 5 or 10.
Yada, yada.
And I get the rights to The Shadow, and I want to do a Shadow movie. And an agent for Sam Raimi, who had done Spider-Man 1 and 2 at that time, they said he's the biggest Shadow fan in the world. And he really would like to do the Shadow movie with you. Would you meet him, please? I said, I would love to meet him. They said, you know, we tried to get the rights to the Shadow before. He couldn't get it, so we made Darkman. And so I go to meet Sam Raimi. And as I meet him, I'm introduced to him, and I say, great to meet you. He says, well, you know, we've met before. And I said, I am so sorry. He goes, you were speaking at a convention in Indianapolis.
Oh my God!
75.
I didn't know this. Oh my God!
I said, "Yeah, I was." He goes, "I got on a bus. I was going on my first ever boy-girl skiing trip in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I had
which
just
is a story in itself, I bet."
He said, "I had just come from the comic book store, and I read my first issue of The Shadow, and that made me a super Shadow fan and a huge comic book fan." And then I realized, oh my God, there were like 8 issues before this that I hadn't read. And Sam made the decision to get off the bus, go back to the comic book shop to get the other 8 issues rather than go on the ski trip. So he's telling me this, and he said, when I saw that you, the writer of The Shadow, was going to be in Indianapolis, I begged my parents to drive me to Indiana so I could go to this convention. He said, I sat in the room.
Wait a minute, Sam Raimi's younger than me? That's depressing.
He was probably your age, actually. So he said, I sat in the back of the room, and I listened to your talk, and afterwards, I went up to you with all my comic books and asked you if you would sign them. He said, you spent 20 minutes talking to me. And he goes, I've never forgotten it. He goes, I have all your stuff. Let's make a movie together. It was like an unbelievable moment. Thank you, Bob.
Can we have someone take a bow here? Because another CPL alumni just walked into the room.
Who's here?
Steve Grant, would you stand up, please? It's only been 40-something years. How you doing, brother? We were just talking about you, weren't we, guys? We were just talking about you. Yeah. Everybody got their start with that bag, you know?
All right, so you're sleeping on Simonton's floor.
Yeah, no, actually, I found a place in Derby, Connecticut, and I started working for Wally Wood. This was toward the end of his career at DC, when he was doing All-Star Comics. And me and a guy named Al Sorois were his two assistants at the time, and that was it was an amazing experience. Woody was an incredible teacher, but a very tortured human being, as you know. And So after about 9 months, Woody decided that he was going to get out of comics altogether. And so at that point, Dickie lived in Connecticut there to Dick Giordano, who I'd already known, and he decided to take me under his wing there. So from working with Woody, I went on to work. This is as a background assistant. Back then, there were only about 30 comics being published in the entire comic world, so you usually had to wait for someone to die to get a book. You know, you moved up by attrition or whatever, or retire or whatever like that. So most of us did our apprenticeships, and I apprenticed, for 3.5 years or something, right? Doing background art, you know, inking trees and rocks and cars and buildings and all the non-fun stuff, so the artist could get enough pages done that you can make a living, because the rates were... Steve, what, back then, the rates were like for inking and writing and all that stuff, were like... garbage, right?
I think in 1978
it was $18 a page. Okay, I rest my case, all right? So I think I got $5 a page for doing background art. So you had to do a lot of pages.
Man, you should have been writing for DC. I got paid $20 a page.
$20 a page, Steve, you missed it. Well, not everyone is an entrepreneur, okay? What can I tell you?
Tell us about Dick Giordano.
Dick Giordano was the closest thing I ever had to a father. Now, I'm not going to go on too long about this because I'll get emotional, all right? But I grew up as a, you know, without a dad, and he was probably everybody's dad, you know, as you well know, as Jill well knows. Yeah, it's like, if you knew him, I don't know how many, but Steve, you know. It's like, I mean, he was one of the most lovable, like, intelligent, good-spirited human beings you'll ever meet. And he saw a lot of potential in me, but he also knew that I was a troubled kid, you know? And the biggest change in my life was, I used to ride in the train from Connecticut into Continuity in those days, you know, because he and Neil worked at Continuity Studios. And so I would go in to work with him there. And I would deliver pages for people, and that's how I got my foot in the door and stuff. But one time, I'm sitting on the train, and I got a funny book in my hand. And he's reading the, you know, Wall Street Journal or whatever the hell Dickie was reading. And I'm sitting there reading a comic book, and he kind of reaches over and goes, pushes it down. I'm like, hey, what? And he goes, he looks at me, and he goes, Bobby. He goes, Bobby. He goes, what's your intention? And I said, what do you mean? He goes, is this going to be your job or your hobby? And I said, no, I want it to be my job. He says, well, it can't be both. He goes, if you're ever going to be good at what you do, he goes, especially you, he goes, you have a head for being on both sides of everything. He goes, it can't be your hobby. He goes, so you have to decide, you know, if you know you're going to be a professional or whether this is going to be what you do for entertainment. So the next week I sold my entire comic book collection. Boom. Because, you know, his word was law to me, and I wanted this more than anything. And he was right. You know, at the end of the day, he was right. For me, because I've been able to do everything in this business, because I focused on the job of doing comics, of making comics, of creating stories, of creating businesses out of this. And it's all because he was smart enough to see that in me when I was 19 years old, you know? And it's just, it was a pivotal moment for me, because I realized that He knew that I had to make a choice about, you know, how I was going to approach this life.
Bob, that night in Hall H, when I was there and saw you get that standing ovation and being embraced by the entire cast and crew of Iron Man, if you could have wished for anybody to be in Hall H, would it have been Dick?
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt. See, now he's going to get me emotional. I'm not going to do that. Jill knew him really well, too. But, yeah, I was with him when he died. And it was like, he died great. He was a perfect gentleman right up to the end. You know, he never once said, "Oh, poor me," or any kind of thing like that. He knew it was time. You know, he never whimpered, or he did say one cuss word once, which Dickie never cursed. And he did say at one point when he was fighting for air, at one point he actually let out a F-bomb, which I thought was awesome. He was like, I never heard, in the 40 years that I knew him, I never heard him curse, you know. And he struggled, got up on one arm because he had been laboring to breathe because he had complications to pneumonia. And I'm sleeping in a chair for 10 days in ICU with him. My beard had actually grown through the mask that I had on, right? But he gets up on one arm, he kind of takes the thing out of his mouth, he looks at me, he goes, "Fuck." You know, and then he goes back to sleep. You know, it was just like so much work, you know, just to stay alive. But he never bemoaned his fate or anything like that. But I remember, I'll tell you one really great story. This is going to turn into a testimonial to Dick. You know how hospitals are, guys. Anybody work in a hospital here? So I can talk bad about nurses. Great. All right. They treated him the way they treated all the old folks who were in there dying, like just slabs of meat on a table, right? And one night they were just, "Mr. Giordano, you gotta take your medication." But, you know, they were just, you know, they were just treating him, what I felt was disrespectful. And I remember saying, I go, "Do you know who this man is here?" And I proceeded to go down the list of his accomplishments, all the things he had done, you know, the Watchmen, the Dark Knight, all the things they would know, you know, that he brought to the medium, to our lexicon. And I read him the riot act. I want you to know who you're sponge bathing there, okay? And who you're, like, you know, show him respect.
Now you know why I'm doing this today. And why I've been friends with this guy for 40 years. This is a special guy. It really is. What about Marvel? How'd that happen?
Well, that was really interesting. I've told the story a lot of times, but basically, I was delivering pages for Dickie and for Woody when he was still doing a few things. So I knew the people up at Marvel. I was an errand boy, right? But I took the job because it got my foot in the door. And one time I was in there delivering stuff for Dickie, and I passed I'm into John Romita's office, and he's like freaking out because he's got this issue of Iron Man, and the inker, whoever it was, broke his hand or some kind of thing like that, and there was only 3 days before this thing was due at the ship, I mean to the printer. So I said, "Mr. Romita, sir," I said, "I can do it." And I showed him my samples. I said, "Yeah, I can do it in 3 days." And John at this point was like, "Okay, kid, don't let me down. You'll never work again," you know, that kind of thing. So I said, "Fine." So I had a plan. So I took all the pages. I ran back over down Madison Avenue to Continuity, right? I went up, and up there at that time, I was apprenticing, but so was Terry Austin, Bob McLeod, Joe Rubenstein. I go down the list. It's like a who's who of comics, right? We're all like 19, 20 years old up there working for Neil and Dick, right? So I start passing out pages. I said, "Do everything but the Iron Man figures." You know, I did, you know, what I did as a background guy, right? And so I said, "I will buy beer." Because I want you to know that in those days, Continuity was fueled on beer. That was the engine that made it run. In fact, when Dickie was dying, I was doing confessions of things we did up there in Continuity Studios after hours that he never knew. He was very upset. You know, but I figured I should tell him before he dies, right? There was a lot of debauchery going on in that place once he went home for the evening. So all the guys, we gangbanged the thing, and we got it done in 3 days. No sleep. Nobody slept or anything like that. You know, just lots of beer, blah, 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 blah. And we did it, and I went and I turned it back in, and I'm looking at this horrible shit, and I'm saying, "Oh my God, my career's over. What was I thinking? Oh my God." And I went back home to my place in Connecticut, and I just figured I went back to doing my background art, right? And about 2 weeks later, a package shows up on my doorstep. And I open it up, and it's an entire issue of The Champions. And it says Bob Hall on it, right? So I figure it's like, okay, he sent it to the wrong Bob. So I call up Marvel. I said, "Listen, I got a package here by mistake. Maybe you'd like to have it back or whatever." You know, I said, "I can put it in the mail." They go, and it was a Romita. He says, "No." He goes, "You're the new inker on this book." He goes, You did what you said you were going to do, and that's how I got my first series. They canceled it 3 issues later, though.
Okay. So how do you make your mark, or how do you network within Marvel to move up to Iron Man and then get the kind of creative freedom you and David wound up with?
Well, I bounced back and forth from Marvel and DC for a while, because back then you just took work wherever you could get it. You know that. Yeah. You did the same thing, right? And what happened was I formed my partnership with David Michelinie over at DC. I had done one issue of the X-Men, and I left the X-Men because I thought it was a dumb book. Shows you I'm not a genius, right? And I love Dave Cockrum. He was my buddy. He goes, I didn't like the inking. Come on, Bob, ink the book for me. I did one issue. It was a bi-monthly, so that means you got paid every 2 months, right? We love bi-monthly books back then, right? And I just said, these aren't the X-Men I know. Which we'll get to later. I said, I don't know who these guys are. Their costumes are really difficult, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And then DC offered me $5 more a page, so I went over there and signed a contract for a year, you know. So I did All-Star Comics there. I inherited Woody's book. And I teamed up with Dave on a book called Star Hunters. And I came into it from the very beginning, and I said, Are you open to ideas? Because I said I read your plots, and I, you know, and back then that's when Dave was still flexible, and I said, Steve, see that was the laugh I was looking for. So yeah, it's Dave and I began co-plotting together. That's where it started before Iron Man on this doomed series called Star Hunters, right? But we knew that the company was going to start cutting back. And I said, come back to Marvel with me. You know, Dave was kind of a DC guy. I said, come back to Marvel with me. We'll find something, right? And so we went over. And back then, they would try you out on books they were getting ready to cancel. Did you write a bunch of stuff that was going to get killed when you first went over there?
Yeah, but I knew it was going to kill. It was never going
to
get a job.
Right, but that's how they tried us out. They tried us out, that young talent, on books that they knew they were going to die, right? And Iron Man was one of those books slated to be canceled. And I told Dave, take Iron Man. Because I think the other one was Ghost Rider. I forget what, there was a third one. But my whole life, I used to draw my own Iron Man comics. Doom Quest, up there, the Iron Man 150, was a story I came up with when I was 11 years old. All right? It was, I made my own little, because I was always a King Arthur fan. I read the Arthurian tales, and I was always a big fan. And I remember, if I had kept that comic, it'd be worth a fortune right now. You know, that little 11-year-old thing. But I told Dave about it one time when we were plotting. He goes, I love that. Let's do it. But so Dave knew nothing about Iron Man. He knew nothing about Marvel continuity at all, which was a plus. I said, well, just trust me. We're gonna go off my impressions of what was good about it, and we're going to forget everything else. You know? And I said, it's got to be about Tony Stark, because all my life, let's face it, all I ever really wanted to be was Tony Stark. I didn't want to be Iron Man. You know? I wanted to be the smartest guy in the room, with all the money and all the toys and all the girls.
Ah.
Yeah. So.
What a strange fantasy.
Yeah, all right. But that's a fantasy that all guys have more than putting on an iron suit and flying around and beating up Ultimo now, isn't it?
It depends on who your friends are.
Yeah, exactly. Well, again, Dickie, I didn't get to see that. Would you hold it back? Oh, thank you. Okay. So we got a tryout. We kind of asked very politely, may we change a few things? And they're like, yeah, you know, it doesn't matter, we're canceling the book. So you notice the first two issues that Dave and I did, we just murdered everyone in the cast. We killed people left and right. We blew up everybody on page five. We blew the Tony Stark robot's head off. We just killed everybody. And it's like, it wasn't until, I think, 117, 118 rather, the one where he's falling out of the helicarrier, that we actually started doing our Iron Man. That was where we introduced the Hall of Iron. We introduced Rhodey, you know, Mrs. Arbogast, the cast that would later become part of the lexicon of the characters. But also, I wanted him to be a badass, and I wanted him to be cool more than anything. I wanted him believable and cool. So that was the mandate from that point.
How many issues in did they turn to you and say, all right, we're not going to cancel this?
By our sixth one, it was selling 200,000 copies a month. Yeah. So, yeah, it was one of those first major miracles where we kind of bailed that out entirely. So yeah, the book, you know, was a mainstay after that, you know.
And if you are now really recognized mostly for that, tell me what the one thing is that you're the most proud of during that stint on Iron Man that has really put you into legendary status.
Well, that's a leading question, isn't it? Because you know,
maybe.
Yeah, we're talking about Demon in a Bottle.
Yeah.
Yeah, the very first story that dealt seriously with alcoholism in a comic book. Yeah, you know, something near and dear to my heart is, you know, coming from a long line of alcoholics myself, you know, all late men generally die in a gutter, you know, clutching their liver. Yes.
But you did something that will last, something that impacts people. And just like we were in our last panel, we were talking about Will Eisner and his spirit and how he touched on the emotional thing that people could react to and flaws in a character. And you really touched a nerve with that storyline and in terms of who Tony Stark would be from then on.
Yeah, because, you know, the heart attack thing became outre, because by then, you know, as you know, heart transplants were commonplace, artificial hearts were commonplace. It seemed like the smartest guy in the world had figured that one out by now. But Dave and I knew we had to give him a weakness that was internal, just like King Arthur, which we used as a template. He had to be a flawed leader, you know, a flawed king, you know. And in the corporate world that we were creating, that seemed to be the logical way to go. And that stayed. I mean, here's the biggest triumph to me. Is when people write articles about the Marvel movies or something like that, they will refer to that story by name. It's the only comic book story I know of that actually the title is referred to by mass media. You know, they know that, yeah. And that to me is like the biggest feather in our cap. This is so few comics is known to the general public by its title, you know, the title of its story.
So here you are, this great Marvel artist. We now know when you were a kid, really, you were an entrepreneur, businessman, publisher of fanzines, and then one day you are Mr. Head Honcho of this new upstart comic book company called Valiant.
Yeah.
And you're kind of running the show, you and Mazarsky.
Yeah.
What happened?
We had to create a company where your son David could come in and just absolutely run rampant in and steal as many books as possible, especially gold books. He would run in the back of the hallways. You bring him in. He'd run in the back of the hallways and carry as many gold books as he could in his arms.
He was a Valiant fiend as a kid. Still has his entire Valiant collection.
Yes. It's crazy. I loved it when he'd come up there. You know, he'd just go nuts, right? But I'll tell you a real quick story, then let's take some questions,
yeah, okay,
too, because,
good.
You know, let's not dwell on it, because I know you probably have a few. The main thing about Valiant, and this will touch you, because it's about someone you know. There was a great inker at Marvel and DC, and Steve knows, named Jack Abel.
Sure.
Jack was a great, great artist and a great New Yorker. Okay, I mean, Jack was just that mainstay, old school role, you know, short sleeve, white shirt, just do the job, could ink with a precision that would just astound anybody and make anyone look good. And Jack had a stroke. What year did he have a stroke, Steve? Yeah, it was like in the mid 80s, and so he lost the use of his drawing hand. Now inside of him was still the artist that he always was, and Jack was a great guy. We used to make fun of Gil Kane a lot. He hated Gil Kane because Gil Kane was a bad Jew, you know. But so Jack had his stroke. He wound up being a proofreader at Marvel. They put him in. Now Steve remembers this too, though. They put him in that little alcove, and the knowledge, all the knowledge he'd accumulated for all those years, was still inside him. But he could no longer perform. And I suddenly realized one day that's how we all go. There's no retirement home. There's no 401k for cartoonists. There's nothing. That's our fate. We wait until something falls off or we can't do it anymore, and then we wind up doing something we hate, you know, till we die. And I realized I didn't want to be that guy. And so when the offer came up from Mazarsky and Shooter to start this new company, I thought it was a chance for me to be something other than a wage slave. And so even though Iron Man was at the height of its popularity, I left Marvel. I was on contract there for 15 years.
Wow.
I left because I saw this as an opportunity for me to be more than just another inker or another penciler or another writer. So we went over there. And the first few years were a struggle. I mean, it was good because, you know, say what you want about him as a writer, but Shooter was never a good manager, and he managed to manage that place into a mess. But fortunately, by the time I got to take the reins, we were able to turn that around really quick. And we wound up being the third largest publisher in America.
It was a glorious period.
It was. And it's still one of the best times of my life. That was Camelot for comics. quote Sean Chin on a great line, because Sean Chin was one of the guys who started with us, went on to have a great career elsewhere, but about 5 years ago, he corners me, and he goes, I owe you an apology. And I said, why? He says, I thought all comic book companies were like yours. He goes, it wasn't until I went to work at Marvel, DC, I didn't realize how good I had it at Valiant. You know, I said, that's the highest compliment I've ever gotten from anybody.
It was very creative, friendly.
It was. We were like a family. And most of us are still in touch with each other to this day. We still stay close. And I'm very happy that Valiant's still around. And that Dinesh and Fred and all the guys are doing a great job of keeping that alive, that legacy alive for me. It's something I'm incredibly proud of.
Questions? Here we go. Sir?
Is it cool to talk about future comics?
Yeah, sure. What about them? They're dead.
That was with Dick, right?
Yeah, that was with Dickie. And this is one of those great Dickie moments, too. Now, as you know, I lost my shirt on that Enterprise, but it was a great idea. But you ever see Tucker, the movie Tucker? All right? About a guy who invented the greatest car in the world, but about 20 years too early. And the rest of the companies ran him out of business. Dickie comes and says, there's the only way that we can be profitable as an independent, given the marketplace or whatever, is to distribute the books ourselves. So he and I came up with that idea to directly distribute to comic shops through the internet, because e-commerce was in its infancy then. And he said, that's the only way three old farts can really come off as being rebels, is to do it on the business side. So, as soon as it was a great idea, whose time has probably come for somebody, but we really didn't have enough funding, and then Diamond, of course, put their boot heel right on our neck. So we were doomed. But the idea was to create comics that weren't continuity heavy, that could be read by mass market, and we distributed it to retailer friendly retailers. Everything was returnable with our books. You know, all the stuff that retailers had bitched to me about at those Diamond meetings, we tried to address with Future Comics. But they made sure. Plus, the other thing was retailers, most of them were notoriously cheap. Only half of them were wired to the internet to begin with, you know. We found out after doing a survey that half of them were still using a cigar box as a cash register, you know. So, yeah, it was a great idea that it came a little too early, you know. But those characters are still around, and who knows? You know, one day I might sell them off to somebody or revive them in some fashion. It would be nice. It would be nice to bring them back.
Wait a minute.
In your last issue on X Factor, the issue ends with the Perseverance of Apocalypse and Shadow. Do you have any ideas of what the character
would be? Oh, no, yeah, I know. It wasn't Apocalypse. This is what I love. I don't know if I want to say this on tape, because I really hope that Fox makes a mistake and pays me a royalty for him. But I did not create Apocalypse, even though he was in the last issue of my last issue of X-Factor, which is my revival of the X-Men, because I remember Dave Cockrum, we're back to him. I'm like, these aren't the X-Men, so I decided to bring back the old X-Men, you know, into their own book. So, yeah.
Which is great for me.
Right. And it held Marvel sales records. Up until X-Men 1, I held the all-time sales record of Marvel, 750,000 copies.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was a huge hit. But they made my life miserable there, okay? Because it was not an X-Men book. It was a book outside the X-Men editorial office, so I had to get approval on everything I did there. And they rejected every single page I did constantly. I mean, it was just, they were out to kill this book. To the point, and I have one standard rule about comics, and Mike, you know this is true in all the years, because you've seen me walk away from a ton of money, too. Yeah, you know that. When I left Valiant, I left $1.7 million on the table just to get out of the job.
Principle.
Yes, on principle. When it's not fun, don't do it. Because the great thing about working in comics is that it's fun. You get to have fun at your job. So why do it if it's not fun?
Here, here.
So, yeah. So, I told them they could take X Factor and shove it up the kazoo, and I went on to do other things. I think I went and did another Hercules. I think I did Secret Wars actually after that, didn't I? I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't matter. You're not a Marvel guy, so you don't know. But my character, Jackson Geis, is here. You can ask him about it too. He's there at the con. What I wanted to do was a gothic horror story with mutants, something that hadn't really been done. And you know how they mutated the beast to be the blue fuzzy beast? Well, I did that to the Daredevil villain, the Owl. And he became kind of a feathered Nosferatu. that could only feed himself on mutant flesh. And I was going to do a real horror story. I mean, a real horror story with X-Factor, right? And so the last panel was this sort of feathered, with his head unnaturally turned, this feathered creature kind of hunched back, you know, out. Jackson drew the creepiest thing you'd ever seen in your life, man. It was, and of course, when I left, they erased it and they drew in Apocalypse, okay? But so I get erroneously credited as the creator of Apocalypse. Thank you, Fox. I will take the check.
I have time for one last quick question, sir.
I want to thank you. When I was 12 years old, I was brought to my first ever comic book store, and there was Thor 356 with that just amazing cover with Hercules pushing Thor off to the...
Oh, yeah. That was voted one of the top 100 covers of all time, too. Yeah.
I picked that up, and the cover is what pulled me in. Your cover.
It was so dumb, wasn't it?
It was funny, and a 12-year-old kid, that was just... It was great to have Hercules on there with the girls, and it was like, and now 30 years later, I am still collecting comics. And I
Well, don't blame me.
It was great.
Well, you know, that's funny because they did, along with those top, you know, 20 comics of all time, they also did top 100 covers at Comic Book Resources of all times. I was fortunate to have 5.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, in the top 100 of all time. That was one of them right there, yeah. Secret Wars.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope that you've had a little bit of insight, not only into this legendary artist, but into this human being and into this entrepreneur. And I ask one favor of you before we call it quits. He just mentioned before that in his life, the only time he ever got a standing ovation was in Hall H.
Oh, you bastard.